You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void. Generally, when I have the urge to walk, it is directly away from the cup and saucer mayhem of civilization, away from the perpendicular portrait of roads and buildings. I walk into the endless collapse of a blurry woods, or over the vein-like bridle paths of some preserve, or up and down the hills and mountains, or along the endless signature of some river. It is not that I dislike people, or buildings, or their assignments. Not at all. Nor am I particularly, or egregiously, fond of nature. No, I do not walk in the woods to find trees. In fact, I often hardly see the sticks and streams. I walk in the woods, in a way, to be erased. Like some curiously inverted Hansel, I leave a path of unfindable crumbs, which, if they could be followed, would not lead me back home, or, rather, while they may literally lead back to my cabin, they would more so extend backward in time to what has been, however temporarily, left behind, a rather moody old man having trouble remembering his point and purpose. As I struggled down the fields of snow into town, it was with the intention that I would, after coffee at the cafe, make my way quickly away into the side woods. Slow going in this mattress of frost, to be sure, but I was in no hurry and had no destination. Going into town, one enters the factory of civilization, the mysterious realm of errands and politics, a vast machine that operates strangely well from its premise of being blown to bits. For the mechanical parts and cogs, the wheels of it, the people, their actions and thoughts, function best and only in disconnected scatter. The cafe was crowded and slush-floored. There was neither place to stand nor sit, so I took my paper cup outside. I sipped for a while in the cold and cast about, wondering which woods to enter, when, on the frigid wind, I tasted the mild offence of a cigar. I am one of those animal-like persons who welcomes fragrances of all variety, good and bad. The torched earth scent of a cigar, like an armchair on fire, has always put me in a better mood. Since I was in no rush, I thought I might, before heading away from it all, wander the icy walks of town to continue my enjoyment of the felonious smoke. I headed down the main street, and losing the scent, I turned more broadly around, scanning without success for the telltale puffs. Along the far side of the square, in his grey tracksuit, I saw Owen Martindale, an 80-year-old marathoner, jogging slowly along. As far as anyone could tell, his entire life was spent exercising. I finished my coffee and dropped the cup in a barrel and prepared to wander off. But I noticed I was feeling particularly content, right there and then, right in the middle of town. It was a beautiful day. 1,000 clean sheets of fresh snow covered over everything, putting little diamonds here and there. I felt limber, my belly warm, and my mind, which had been troubled and low, was now peaceful. I wondered if I might, just this once, promenade the town in place of the wilderness. I continued to the end of the line of the stores, and then crossed back over Main Street, along the sleepier side of the commons, past the post office, the police station, the massive rocket ship of St. Michael's. The town square is not, in fact, a square, but triangular in shape, and for some reason one of these sides has never been usurped to any good use and remains a small, vacant field rising into the forest. During rare, large events, the field is used as a makeshift parking lot. A number of older men and women use the downtown as a kind of frugal sports club, doing breathless laps in the early morning to keep their lungs and legs in finest form. 80-year-old Owen Martindale was the most advanced champion of the club. He used a birch branch in the park for pull-ups. He did push-ups on a flat square of granite before the statue of Theodore Bock, the first resident of Lemon. Owen had about a dozen provisional workout stations in all. One of these was particularly irritating to the ladies in town. Perhaps they were concerned that he might slip as he took his great steps on and off a large park boulder, hands firmly planted on his waist. A footballer's exercise, I termed it to myself. But this activity caused grimaces and grave concern in discussions of fair use of public domains. No matter the weather, Owen wore his storm-grey tracksuit and large white trainers. Even when he wasn't exercising, his face remained locked in the grief of invigoration, as though while even standing about, he was in the middle of some unseen but crushing form of exertion. His bruised red skin remained, ever splintered with whiskers. His mouth hung wide, to freely siphon the oxygen from the air. I tried to ignore Owen as I maneuvered past the barren side of the square and turned my attention instead to the rickety bench near the fire hydrant. The bench was driftwood on a bracken of black-painted iron roots. The hydrant was a knotted thumb rusting from the cement. Conspicuous, both of them, for their mislocation, unsupported as they were by any tissue of function. For here, on this uncivilized side, there was nothing to convey potential involvement. No bus stopped here, and the hydrant was uselessly distant from any building. In point of fact, whenever I mentioned these outliers during casual in-town discussions that sought the bottom-line meaning of this or that, no one ever seemed to know what I was talking about. The bench, I would say. The hydrant on the abandoned side of the square. Even pointing to it from the cafe, I could barely get a response. It occurred to me, as I moved past them, that the best thing to do here was set the bench on fire one day and see what followed. The next best thing available to an old non-hooligan, I decided, was that I should sit on the bench. As I lowered myself down, I was curious to note that the pressure of my body on the semi-destructed shards caused a kind of stick to rise suddenly upward from the iron mess below. I took hold of this stick, assuming I had broken the bench with my usage, but found the pole completely resistant. Only upon standing did the metal wand dip back into place. I rose and sat several times, watching the disturbing pole snap back and forth. I gave up, finally, in favor of a quiet rest. I watched, infuriating Owen Martindale carry out his duties, doing large sums of pull-ups from the birch branch, then down onto the ground for 100 push-ups. Then Owen went to his boulder. Several old ladies labored by and complained, but with laughter, as they passed me, that Owen would surely kill himself today. I sat, daydreamed, drifted. It wasn't such a bad bench after all. In fact, being as poorly situated as it was, it offered its own peaceful detachment. When I roused, I noticed, at the top of the reticulating post, a small bit of greenishly tinged sea glass. With a small lean, I easily glanced through the lens. As unhelpful to vision as the crystal smear was, it did set the lasso of my sight, and there, in its frame, directly enclosed and centered, on the distant hill above the Lemon River, I saw, under a decorative vest of snow, a second bench. It has always been my policy to follow the instruction of benches. If one bench was eager to tell me of the existence of another, then I must, without question, immediately venture forth to pay that recommended bench a visit. From a bench in the town to a bench in the trees, under fallen old snow over fallen old leaves. Like a leaky old boat on an empty old sea, you leak till you're empty, when empty you're free. I'd like to climb like a golden flower, sunlight for bread, until it's my power in a ballroom dream. I'd dance with the old river queen. She'd sing me a song in my dream, and erase everything that I'd seen. Blanket of snow, a graveyard of cars, a comet, a puddle, the smoky old stars. I like the way there isn't a way to find out the way there isn't a way. I'd like to climb like a golden flower, sunlight for bread, until it's my power in a ballroom dream. I'd dance with the old river queen. She'd sing me a song in my dream, and erase everything that I'd seen. As I departed for the second bench, I grew more and more curious. Had someone set this strange contraption up, or was it purely coincidental that the shard of glass on the saluting pole inadvertently circumscribed the second bench? Both alternatives seemed implausible. I walked through the park. Owen Martindale stood in the old gravy lump of his exhaustion, snow-dusted and heaving beneath his workout tree. We greeted each other with civil nods, but as I continued by, he turned and whispered, "So?" It was very nearly a cough. I slowed and regarded him. "Did you say something, Owen?" I said. I always spoke to him as though he were in hospice, an old vet in a wheelchair at the edge of a scenic vista. He looked over my shoulder to the rickety bench. "Second bench, I gather," he said.
I understood him perfectly, but didn't take to the casual way he spoke of the queer mystery.
"I thought I might," I said. "Well, keep looking when you get there. Ears sharp. It's not just what you see now."
He said this grandly, as though he'd just passed along a remarkable bit of wisdom, which I refused to acknowledge, and which refusal caused him to smile in a tin can sort of way, a warm, ripped in aluminum grimace that somehow meant he'd come out on top. I certainly could have asked Owen about his experience with the benches, or tried to find out what he knew about the stick and the lens, but but I was too pleased to have found some purpose to the day to inquire. Owen raised a bare, pig-knuckled hand and dismissed me. "Go on, then," he said. I touched my hat in a disgruntled manner and set off. There were no cars in the street now, no wind, no Owen even, as I glanced back. He dropped to give himself 20 behind a snowbank. I took the quickest way over the trestle bridge and then stepped down from the tracks upon the untrodden hillock on the far side. I descended slowly through a thin forest, trying to make my way to the middle of the hill, where I supposed the bench would be. The Lemon River burbled below a paving of ice, but further upstream there rose a clamour from where the fast black water moved too swiftly to coalesce. I paused here and there to tune my geography and foraged about the hill until the distant buildings of Lemon revealed a narrow fissure through which I could see the original rickety bench and rusty hydrant. If I kept these in my sights, I felt I could navigate up and down the hill until success. Yet again, my hypothesis proved wrong. For several minutes, I walked in a kind of haphazard spiral, a child lost in the woods. But then I heard a sound, faintly bristling, the crackle of static, as from a transistor radio. As I moved toward the noise, I began to hear a more distinctive brown mumbling, a voice hovering in the shushing scratch. I remembered Owen's unwanted suggestion that my ears would help me more than my eyes, and I turned and aimed for the sound point. Another 2 minutes, and in a low, unexpected place, violating my sense of its location, I found it. The moment I arrived at the second bench, the squelched narration from the transistor stopped. I cleared the snow from the boards, examined the entire bench for signs of any sneaky, reticulating pole, and finding none, I sat. Adjacent to the second bench was a worn-out stump that resembled the knobby hydrant at the first bench. Set within this stump, in a large owl hole, I saw a familiar black box with a silver face, a small recording device and player I had not seen in many years, a carrycorder. As to the command of my discovery, the carrycorder hissed back to life. So damaged was the sound quality, and so lacking the conversation, and so spotted with long patches of noisy silence, that I at first imagined I was hearing some ancient recording of Thomas Edison or Mark Twain set into a loop. But then something struck me cold. Not the sound of the voice, though it should have, but more so the content. Not only was it troubling that I'd failed to recognize my own voice, and in addition, that I had been recorded unwittingly during my short stint at the first bench, but most shockingly, I had no idea that I'd been talking aloud. There came a silence in which I imagined I may have fallen asleep, or just simply daydreamed. I heard the vague Owen on the Rock inspired laughter of the two old women who'd trundled past. As I listened, my eye caught sight of awful Owen Martindale on the far side of the river, gambling down through the snow. He certainly knew that I would be here on the second bench, and it was possible that this hill running was just a part of his routine. But I doubted it. My eyes followed him along. He came to a stop, waved his arms, and then dashed away up the hill. But the place where he'd stopped was arresting in itself, for along that stretch of the Lemon River was a small patch of green and yellow, blown free of snow, a completely cleared parcel of green grass and yellow beach sand. And right in the middle of the sand, at the very edge of the water, a third bench. I was furious with Owen Martindale, and yet my underlying sentiments at that moment echoed exactly my own earlier ones.
There's really no choice, Alfred. If one bench tells you about another bench, you go.
Welcome home, little sparrow. Settle your wings and I'm at your command. 'Cause I've trained in the treetops and I've built you a nest in the palm of my hand. Soon we'll take the night home. I knew that I occasionally spoke to myself, especially in the cabin at night as I tried to get myself to bed, or in the morning as I assembled breakfast or made grocery lists. Also, I sometimes sang, very purposefully, with complete self-knowledge. But I was absolutely sure, despite the evidence, that I did not chat to myself like a silly bird in a tree. Going about describing the minutiae of my experiences to invisible friends? Inconceivable. It was vexing, and I rejected it. This ruling that I had not spoken to myself thus created a fresh possibility. And within this nexus of strange benches and secret recordings, I perceived that I was being subjected to some unpleasant practical joke. There was no whimsy here, but something cold, possibly cruel, all of which bore the signature of that near-death Adonis, nasty tracksuit Owen Martindale. But yet, I could not help it. The third bench, threatening as it was in the wrong greenness of grass, beckoned. I hated obliging Owen, who obviously wanted me to make my way to the third bench, yet I had to satisfy my own curiosity. As I walked down the hill toward the ice, I suddenly noticed my own lips quivering involuntarily their rebuke of Owen and of the possibility of myself talking. I was arguing out loud how it was not true that I talked to myself in the exact way that I was. At the river's edge, I petted at the ice with the toe of my boot. Then with my stick, I began to pound down as a further test. I never trust ice. It is, without question, the least reliable form of water. But as I was loath to lose my vision of Owen's sinister green oasis and the third bench, I decided to cross the river to keep it all in steady view. Out on the ice, the sound of my stick continued to issue a reassuringly tight report. But as I crept onto the wind-blown middle, the white ice grew dark, window-thin. I could see the cloudy fingers and pin-bubbles of water thieving madly below. I pushed along in a semi-panic, and soon was gliding gingerly forward. "Owen Martindale," I thought to myself, "what are you up to?" Drossy rags of fog lifted from the open water ahead. Could there be, I wondered, a hot spring hereabouts? There were a number of these, lurking thermal pools in Lemon, hidden in the low woods, smoking puddles in the valley. Perhaps such a spring resided beneath the small grotto. I kept my eye fixed on the bench in the sand and sighed with relief as my feet finally hit land. Even at this distance, I could see the third bench had its own version of the hydrant in the form of a small, witch-like wood stove. At the eerie line between snow and grass, I hovered as Alice poised above the rabbit hole. I leaned down, removed a glove, and touched the warm, soft, spring-like earth. I approached the third bench as though it were not a bench at all, but a wild, sleeping animal. It looked entirely similar to the other two benches, a ruckus of sticks on a skeleton of iron. As I took my requisite seat, a light sparkled in the open grate of the witch's wood stove. Where on the second bench I had heard the sounds of myself at the first, at this third bench I was now given witness to that original event. The small oblong screen glowed black and yellow, and I watched a film of myself approaching the first bench in the square. I saw myself sit down, stand, sit, struggle with the stick, my mouth moving along the whole time as I chatted with my invisible friends. After a while, I stopped standing and sitting, stopped fiddling with the stick, stopped even talking to myself. And then, remarkably, I watched myself do the most unexpected thing. My eyes rolled back into my head, and my body slumped to a side. I knew instantly what this was. Further proof of the casual, almost non-existent relationship I had with myself. What exactly I was doing was feigning my own death. As with the self-talking, this was something that I did. I knew I did. On purpose and with full self-knowledge. But rarely, so I thought, and not today, not on the bench, not unconsciously. But the idea would arrive, now and again, here or there. Well, this could be the place of my death. I could very well die right here. And as though to create a poultice against the possibility, I would pretend to die, as it seemed impossible to me that one could actually die after pretending to do so. Thus I would, when the fancy struck, engage in a pantomime of my final moments, and perform the small disappearing act in the manner and form I imagined it would take. On the bench, it took this slumping form, and I had no recollection of it at all. My arms shot out in a rigor mortis and then settled. My eyes rolled back and my head teetered around wildly before coming to a rest. The whole dance of death took only 20 or so seconds before I straightened and became, once again, an old gentleman on a poorly placed bench. The video ended and then began once more from the top. I had no need or interest in seeing myself feign extinction again, so I stood. The image in the stove died. And that is when I saw, resting below the bench, like a smooth river stone, a brown and trampled cardboard box. I pulled it into my arms. As I broke the cold lid free, I knew at once what the folded black garments inside were. My dark suit of invisibility and imperviousness, which I had not worn or considered in many years. The silken, nightshade costume of the stalwarts. There was a note tucked between the shirt and pants that read simply, "Do nothing until it is required," which, to the stalwarts, carried a particular sort of meaning. It was not an injunction that I carry on with my life until some phone call was placed or a mysterious new message arrived. It was quite literally an order that I stay exactly where I was. I was talking to myself again, my mouth narrating the discovery, but this time I listened. There was both pleasure and fear in my voice as I heard myself say it again and again. "My old Honorican. Isn't there something? My old Honorican." I lifted the onyx shirt into the air, my hands trembling, the wind blowing soft above the impossible green grass in the warm air of this small hot springs oasis by the river. I unbuttoned my coat and kicked off my boots. A stalwart, apparently, once more. Listening to atoms, motion, and the void.